And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of March 11th, 2019. Today we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. So, Massachusetts has a long and proud history of being a technological innovator. I've made this case before that Massachusetts has moved from being a farming economy to a fishing economy to a manufacturing economy, while all the mills in Lowell and New Bedford and Haverhill. It went on to become an education economy. In the 70s, it was a high-tech economy when it was the Route 128 miracle, and when that was like leading the nation before Silicon Valley. Right now, Massachusetts is a leader in biotech and pharma and all the stuff in Kendall Square. The next big shift is into clean energy, and that drives the economy of Massachusetts, always has. Part of that connection to a growing economy is the what's called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which has been a cap and trade system that distributes permission for power plants to emit carbon, and you have to pay for the permission, and all that money goes into a fund and generally has been used to fund what's called Mass Save. If you look on billboards occasionally, if you go into your local Home Depot, you'll often see a Mass Save poster where you can get a rebate for buying certain clean and highly efficient devices, like a new furnace or a new washing machine. Right? Mass Save wants to help you. All that money comes from the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. Recently, Governor Baker here in Massachusetts, who has done some good things and some bad things, but as far as climate goes, but there is a move afoot to take some of the money from the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative and essentially give the governor, quote-unquote, flexibility to move that money away from energy efficiency programs and move it over into adaptation programs. That is to say, to distribute that money to cities and towns to build seawalls and or whatever other thing your town wants to build to adapt to climate change. And that leaves you in a quandary, as a climate hawk, in a quandary. Because adaptation, no one says adaptation is a bad thing, but the idea of shifting money away from energy efficiency programs is, I think, bad policy, because we need the full, we need to reduce our carbon emissions, full stop. That's the first order of business. And a shift away from taking the money from the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, taking that and putting it into adaptation, raises the old debate about whether or not rich places like Massachusetts and rich countries like the United States should spend money on adaptation and building seawalls when other parts of the world will suffer the full brunt of increasing carbon emissions, right? That the first thing, the morally correct thing to do is to reduce carbon emissions. So I kind of wandered all on the lot there, Mariah. Tell me, bring me back to the reservation here. What should I think?
Something that struck home with me when I was in grad school and was learning about these things is, and this is not true, this is not how it would go, but for example, you know, there's, if you sort of protect, you know, you build a big seawall, say, to protect Cambridge and downtown Boston, but then you push all of the water, because it's got to go somewhere, into, it would be East Boston, right?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Hull or somewhere up on the North Shore, yeah.
Yeah, so all of that water ends up flooding a lot of low-income areas. And, you know, I think that's not what is being talked about. They're talking about, you know, both building up resiliency for, you know, downtown Boston, Cambridge, MIT, as well as resiliency for East Boston. That's all being considered part and parcel. But it does send you this image of, well, if you stop the water from flooding us, it still has to go somewhere. Where is that somewhere?
Right.
It's probably going to be,
Well,
you know,
I would say it's going to flood Bangladesh.
exactly. It's going to be
Right? It's going to
Kiribati.
go
It's going to be
somewhere.
Maldives. It's going to be the low-lying Pacific Island nations. Exactly. I mean, and that's not, you know, that's a stretch, but it does have to go somewhere unless we stop it from rising. That's the best thing you can do. And then, you know, so I mentioned the last episode, I mentioned this talk I went to at WBUR City Space, this stepping up, which is it's about the businesses in the era of climate change. And they opened the talk with this picture of right after Hurricane Sandy. It's a kind of an iconic picture of Goldman Sachs is just glowing. Every single light is on in the Goldman Sachs building, and the entire rest of New York City is dark because there's no power anywhere, right? Everything has been completely wiped out by Hurricane Sandy. And Goldman Sachs was incredibly prepared for resiliency. They had a generator. They had sandbags to keep the water from coming into the building. They were prepared, and kudos to them, right? That's great. You know, that's how everyone should be thinking, is how do you prepare for these emergencies? Because at this point, we know that they're coming. But nobody could get to Goldman Sachs to work. So what was the point of all the lights being on and sandbags being there? Because the transportation systems were shut down, and the roads were flooded, and people the could, I mean, you just it's broken. It was on, but we can't. It
Nobody's
doesn't
home.
function. Nobody's home, exactly. And I think that's when you are trying to deal with adaptation instead of mitigation. Where do you stop with adaptation? I mean, you can't solve all of these massive problems.
And I think that the distinction, the buzzwords are mitigation, which generally in this context means reducing carbon emissions, and adaptation, which means increasing your resilience of your community against the effects of climate change that are already baked in. And those two things are go hand in hand, are both legitimate. I would just argue that reducing the effort to mitigate the carbon, to reduce the carbon emission, is a wrong way to spend our money, that we should keep that money going full bore and spend additional money on adaptation if need be. And in fact, I saw somewhere that Speaker DeLeo of the House of Representatives is posing a $1 billion basically a loan guarantee for adaptations in cities and towns across the state, so that there's $1 billion. You take it out as a bond, you have to pay it back over the years. But if you want to do some green effort in your town, you can. And so good on him. I mean, whether or not the, again, you're back into the adaptation versus mitigation debate, right? If the state gives you a couple $100 million to build some kind of resiliency thing, good, but would that money be better spent reducing carbon emissions someplace else? So,
Well, it's like the prevention, you know, versus reaction to something, right? So, you know, would you rather go to the dentist regularly and brush your teeth and, you know, work on
pay
that, or just pay for all the cavities to be drilled and all the root canals later?
$2,000 for a new crown later on. Yes,
Exactly, exactly.
exactly. Well, I guess the other thing, so there's a bunch of sort of disparate news, climate change news about in Massachusetts this past week. Another has to do with the Weymouth compressor station. So if you have not been following that saga, let me fill you in. There's a pipeline that has been proposed to come through Massachusetts. An important component of that pipeline is what's called a compressor station, which recompresses the pressure of the natural gas so that it can flow further through the pipeline, in fact, up to Canada to be exported. But put that aside. This big compressor station is being built right in the middle of Weymouth. So if you're familiar with Boston at all, it's right where the Four River Bridge is. I don't think you can see the Four River Bridge from Route 93 north, but you get over there, you go through that Quincy section, you're pretty close to it where this whole thing is going in. And it's right in the middle of a town, and there are serious environmental questions about it, not the least being that it's being built on basically landfill that's going to get submerged with the next big storm. Put all that aside, the governor recently approved and allowed a permit to go forward for the construction of that compressor, which is a bad deal. But the latest news is that the state is going to undertake an additional, I'm not sure if it's parallel or if it's in the critical path, but the state will also make another environmental review of that Weymouth site to see whether or not the nature of the backfill, which I think is ash or something, is safe and you can put a compressor station on. So there's a roadblock, if only a minor roadblock, in the path of this compressor station. But if you want to learn more, there's information about it. You need to Google it. But the Weymouth compressor station is an ongoing choice that I think our governor is making to build infrastructure that will last, probably outlive most of the people listening to this podcast, and will be a fossil fuel infrastructure in the year 2090 that we're still going to be paying for. So it's a bad decision to make, and I'm glad to see that there's another review being undertaken, because that might slow things down.
Right. Yeah, why don't we shunt that money toward adaptation instead, right?
There you go.
Use a lot of money for mitigation, and then we can take the pipeline money and put it towards adaptation. That's a funny thing. You know, Baker has done a lot. Certainly, he's provided some national leadership by going down to D.C. Mm-hmm, and talking to the House Resources Committee, right? Natural Resources Committee to talk about all of the ways that all the bipartisan action that's necessary to address climate change and how important it is. Mm-hmm. And she's done a lot in the state for climate change, for sure. Moving a lot of the, you know, offshore wind forward, and he's doing a lot to tackle climate pollution from cars and trucks. So he's doing a lot for climate leadership in that way. But it's definitely, his actions on this Weymouth compressor certainly leave something to be desired. I think Craig Altimus in the Commonwealth Magazine mentioned that, you know, while Baker's happy to travel more than 400 miles to Washington to speak with Congress, he's yet to venture to his office's waiting room to meet with the Weymouth resident Andrea Onore, who's been sitting in his office during her lunch break for more than 100 days. And also that he hasn't gone to the community of Weymouth. And this is what Altimus is, this is his writing. I haven't verified this, but he said he hasn't gone to the community of Weymouth, where almost every public official has come out against the proposed compressor station. So this is a big
issue.
Dark spot on his climate, on Baker's climate legacy. That's for sure.
I get the feeling that Baker thinks he can cut the baby in half. Right, that if he appeases the right people and does a little bit here and a little bit there, you can kind of, you know, sneak through and won't cause too many waves. And from my feeling, that's the opposite of leadership. Right, in a crisis, we don't need to kind of be dancing around the edges so we don't look bad anywhere. And I mean, even today, Baker appeared in a meeting for offshore wind, right, to tout the development of offshore wind. So he has done some stuff, but then there's other places where it's missing, and it makes you wonder what's the underlying rationale. I don't know.
Yeah. Do you know, would like to know more. So from my understanding, there was a health impact assessment that said there was no toxicity associated with the pipelines, right? That was kind of the original thing, but
my understanding is that the feds needed they needed something from Massachusetts in order for the federal permit to go through. And there were some rules and regulations around that as to what the report needed to look like. As part of that, and based on some demand from Weymouth people last fall, again, this is my belief, I could be wrong, there was a health impact assessment commissioned, and there's some debate about whether the independence of the people that were asked to make the report, it's another one of these consulting companies, they came back and I think basically said, the compressor station doesn't make anything worse, right? Which is kind of a funny statement, right? It doesn't increase the risk of the people living in Weymouth, which is already some level of pollution. But based on that, Baker was able to allow the federal permit to go through, which was important, and at the same time claim that his hands were tied, I think was the quote, that he couldn't change, you know, he had to accept what was going on. He was forced into this state approval by the process, which, again, you say, okay, why would, you know, if you really, if he's governor, if he really didn't want to do that, he could find a way to stop things. So I think that's the background on the health, the HIA is what I see, my health impact assessment.
And then you mentioned that they're doing, I mean, well, I read about this, there's a report called Boston Physicians for Social Responsibility, who released their own assessment of the dangers and health threats and said that there are significant ones and they're strongly against the project. Is that what you're referring to? You mentioned that there was going to be another environmental sort of assessment.
No, this is what I saw is in the Patriot Ledger. It's a state review and it has to do, if memory serves, let me, I've got it probably somewhere on my iPad, but it, I mean, it has to do with, I think, the nature of the landfill they're going to build it on. So, I mean, keep in mind, Weymouth goes back to John Adams' time, right? But the place where they're going to put this compressor station, I think, has been filled in, much the way the Back Bay was filled in, with a bunch of stuff from 100 years ago. So God knows what they used 100 years ago to fill up the land that they now want to build a compressor station on. I think the state is going to make another review of the nature of that landfill and whether or not it's too toxic as it stands or if it's too dangerous to build something there. I think it's different from the PSR report, which
so
is about
two,
health.
Yeah, so right, there's two very serious problems with this compressor, the air pollution and the health risks, and the fact that it would be built on this potentially toxic dump.
Right. Which, as I said before, you know, the next big storm, it'll probably, you'll probably get overwashed because it's, you know, it's right there at the water's edge.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there's all that stuff. Governor Baker, we want to help you do the right thing and be a hard-charging climate leader. And we'll, if you want any advice, call us up. We'll have you on the show. I guess the other interesting thing I just want to take a minute to talk about is this funky idea that's popped up in a couple other places. But I saw a report that said, at least in Cleveland or someplace in Ohio, they have granted to Lake Erie, I hope I'm getting all this right, they granted to Lake Erie legal standing in court so that human beings could sue on behalf of Lake Erie and that Lake Erie could suffer damages and get recompense for harm that had been caused to it. And it's this idea of giving natural features, you know, a river or a mountain or something, legal protection, legal standing all on its own without having to say that some human was hurt by the water, the, you know, the polluted water. You can say the river was damaged and the river has rights. I think that we reported a couple of years ago that there's some section of the Ganges that has legal protection in India, and there's some river in New Zealand that has been granted the same kind of legal protection, a couple other places. But it's a very interesting legal concept and something that is intriguing and doesn't go so far from the other interesting thing that happened this past week. I don't watch 60 Minutes anymore. I used to watch it many decades ago, but I don't see it very much. But I did catch in the YouTube video of a report on this famous legal case we've talked about called Juliana versus the United States, which is basically a bunch of high school kids suing the U.S. federal government because the U.S. federal government is not protecting, being responsible for the trust that the federal government owns to keep the air and water clean for future generations. And so this is a legal theory that we've talked about a couple of times on the show. It's called the public trust. That is to say, the government has the duty to protect the waterways and the air for the common good. And these kids are saying that the federal government is not doing that because it won't control carbon pollution. And once you get on 60 Minutes, you know you've made the big time, right? Mariah, did you get a chance to see it? You probably don't watch 60 Minutes a whole lot either, but we have talked about this case now for 3 or 4 years on this show, and it's very, very good to see it making its way up the legal system, right?
It's great to see it. I'm thrilled. Anytime that case comes up and there's a positive result, I mean, I know even at base value, if they can get it into a court of law to start talking about the environmental mm-hmm. damages and whether it is threatening the youth of America. Are we taking away some of their rights? I think that's a good thing.
It's on a pretty reasonable legal standing, too, because the Corps of Engineers is charged with taking care of the rivers for the common good. Right? So this idea of a public trust that we dredge out the Mississippi, the federal government dredges out the Mississippi to support commercial traffic on the Mississippi, that's managing, holding the Mississippi River in trust for the benefit of the entire country. So it's not that big a leap to say, okay, we should also be protecting the quality of the air for the good of the country. Right? So the legal stuff, it seems to me, makes perfect sense if they can, you know, and they keep arguing, you keep losing until you win in court, I guess. So good for them.
Yeah.
We'll put up links to that that show and a bunch of the other stuff we talked about here. And that those links will be on the blog at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find the show on the Facebook page at /massclimateaction. And, of course, since you're listening to us, you probably already have a podcast distribution app. But you can tell all your friends that they can listen to the Climate Minute on their favorite podcast distribution app as well. If you want, send us an email at podcast to the email, following email address, podcast@massclimateaction.net. And if you're really enthusiastic and you're a climate activist and you're doing something that you think is interesting, take out your cell phone, turn on the voice recorder, the voice memo thing, record a 3-minute description of the good work that you're doing and send it to us. Who knows? Maybe you'll get on the air, as they say. But we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear any comments about how to improve the show or topics you think we ought to cover. So we'll close to where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, because we accept responsibility for a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan. And that equitable plan must use regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our collective future. So, Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.